Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started if we could. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, Section 244103. The date is August 7th, 2007, and the time is about 1:32 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the rulemaking hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Hoffman. And in accordance with the rulemaking notice that was published in the Colorado Register on July 10, 2007. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. Let me make some other introductions. To my immediate left is Wayne Munster, Deputy Director of the Elections Division, and to my immediate right is Hillary Rudy of the Elections Division. As stated in the notice, the purpose is to consider amendments to the rules concerning a number of issues, including amendments as may be necessary to implement amendments to the Colorado election laws that were adopted by the General Assembly in this past legislative session, and answer questions that have arisen under Title I of the statutes, which is the State Election Code. And I think most people know there's a sign-up sheet on the table by the back door. If you intend to testify, please do sign up. Before I turn to public testimony, I would like to, for the record, provide a little bit of information about the rulemaking, summarizing some of the major changes. Some of the amendments are intended to implement Senate Bill 07-234. Which dealt with permanent mail-in voter status. The bill changed to the terminology, changed the term absentee ballot to mail-in ballot, and so there's a lot of conforming amendments, references in the election rules to absentee ballot are being changed to mail-in ballot. There are a number of amendments proposed in the draft rules that deal with implementing Senate Bill 83, and those include changes to the list of acceptable identification or elimination of the 10-minute time limit for voting, additional post-election audit requirements, changes to the petition circulator requirements to conform with Buckley versus American Constitutional Law Foundation, a 1999 U.S. Supreme Court case. Changes to the procedures for protesting the sufficiency or insufficiency of candidate petitions, and additional requirements for the testing and backup procedures relating to electronic poll books. Amendments to Rule 6 are proposed to clarify procedures for managing coordinated elections, specifically those elections that involve jurisdictions shared by two or more counties. These amendments are necessary as part of the implementation of the SCORE statewide voter registration system. Amendments to Rule 10 are proposed to provide clarification to candidates regarding the audio pronunciation of their name. There's clarifications in Rule 10.4 regarding statewide office. There's a new Rule 10.5 that provides deadlines for candidates for local office for the submission of the required information so that the counties can supply their vendors with the sufficient information to program their audio ballots. Amendments to Rule 12 are proposed to implement changes regarding special district elections, changes that were made in House Bill 07-1159. And these amendments establish a process to allow special districts to request a filing extension for their mail ballot plan where the district may cancel the election. The amendments are necessary because the deadline to cancel an election falls after the deadline for filing a mail ballot plan. That summarizes, in general, the proposed changes. The Secretary of State's office prepared a draft of the amendments. There was an initial draft with the initial notice of rulemaking, There was a revised draft that was issued on August 2nd, 2007, and published on the Secretary of State's website. A copy of the revised draft, and we'll work off of the August 2nd version at this hearing, but a copy of that is available on the table at the back of the room. Also available is a proposed statement of basis, purpose, and specific statutory authority. This is something that's required by the State Administrative Procedure Act, and a copy is also available on the table at the back of the room. Since this is a formal rulemaking hearing, the meeting is audio recorded. All comments become a part of the official rulemaking record. The hearing is also broadcast over the Internet. For anybody who wishes to testify, again, I would appreciate it if you would sign up on the sign-up sheets on the table by the back door. For the record, our office has received a number of written comments on the proposed rules. The ones that I have seen so far are from the following: the Election Statute Review Committee of the County Clerks Association, comments from the Clerk's Office of Mesa County, the Clerk's Office of Adams County, the Clerk's Office of Larimer County, and also comments from the Vote by Mail Project and Colorado Common Cause. And there may be others that I don't have yet. And of course, anybody who wishes to testify, of course, you're encouraged, or you're certainly welcome to provide your testimony in written form as well as oral. With that, I'd like to turn to public comment, and I'll work from the sign-up sheet. The first person that I think I have signed up to testify is Kristen Thompson. Sorry. If you would come forward, identify yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
Hi, thanks. My name is Kristen Thompson. I represent the Vote by Mail Project, which is, for the folks who don't know, a 501c3 and c4 nonprofit organization looking to expand access to optional mail ballot voting across the U.S., and Colorado is the first state we've done work in. The notes I brought up are not mine. Hold on 1 second. Happens when you have two pieces of paper in your hand. We did submit written comments, and on those I'm just going to highlight three, and they're on the second page. First of all, we think that the Secretary of State's office did an excellent job in interpreting Senate Bill 234, both the intent and the letter of the law. So I want to thank you for that. Concerning our comments, the first one I'll work off of is Rule 13.16.2, and it has to do with the drop-off locations for mail ballots. It was an amendment that came in at the end of the legislative session, and we may have overlooked a little bit of the language, and I think Hillary was actually part of this discussion, and feel free to correct me, but our intent was that all of the locations that are available for drop-off of mail ballots during early voting remain open for drop-off on election day. I think the way the rule is written now is that it's only one of them has to be open, and I think it was the intent, at least of the proponents, that they all remain open to decrease any confusion for the voter. Who may be getting a lot of information about where they can drop off during early voting, and then it's suddenly different that last day. I remember in the discussions, it turns out that most early voting locations are actually polling locations on election day, so it probably isn't that big a deal. And I remember that being part of the discussion, so we just wanted to comment on that our hope is that all of them will be made available, all of those drop-off locations will be made available on election day. The second comment was on Rule 13.17.1, and this is about how and when people can get information on whether or not their ballot has been received. This probably requires a longer discussion, as I put in my comments. But we think the language of Senate Bill 234 actually says electronically or telephonically as the preferred method for the voter. So we would like to see that language go into the rule instead of it being sort of a written communication that may take a lot more time, that the quickest method, most available method for that clerk is preferred in the language of the law, telephone or electronic. Also, we think this rule should have a timeline affiliated with it, basically that there is a period of time that can be spelled out between when the request is made and when the information is available. We did notice that in Arapahoe County, they've actually already moved ahead with doing an online system, and it was in the paper about 2 weeks ago. So hopefully we can move to that kind of system or some sort of ballot tracking system. In the meantime, I think we do need to spell out in rule what timely manner is. We think that language is too broad. And finally, there was a piece that was not in the rule anywhere, but we just wanted to see added if possible, and that is that this information is made publicly available through the voter file via purchase, however that information gets out to clerks, campaigns that are using it, you know, that the fact that that someone has signed up permanently as an absentee voter is also made publicly available. And that's it. I'm happy to take any questions.
And I'm sorry, could you repeat that last statement? You want the public to know, in anybody who's requested a permanent mail-in ballot, is that correct?
Any information that is made publicly available that's in the voter file currently, so we're not looking to open up and just everyone can have access to anything, but that it's part of the information that's available for purchase or that goes to clerks, campaigns, consultants, whoever is looking to purchase or get that information, so long as it does not violate the confidentiality of the voter.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I didn't quite follow was it sounded like you preferred to have a reference in 13.17.1 to electronic or telephonic means, I believe, since that was in Senate Bill 234.
That's correct.
I mean, Senate Bill 234, I think, said it could be by other means, internet or something like that. I think, but
that's correct.
But you want to, for ease of reference, I think you want that picked up in the rule. Is that correct?
That's correct. Just those are the preferred methods. They were spelled out in Senate Bill 234, and we would hate for someone to go to the or any other first.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call on Faith Gross.
Good afternoon. I'm Faith Gross from the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, and I coordinate our HAVA authorized and federally funded voting rights program statewide for people with disabilities. And I'd like to talk very briefly about what's not in the proposed rules or the existing rules. And this is new language from Senate Bill 83. Specifically, I'm recommending that to reflect CRS 1570410, which says the elector shall have the opportunity to input a candidate's name for each office, that allows a write-in candidate and to review the elector's write-in input, edit that input, and confirm that the edits meet the elector's intent. I wasn't able to find anything in the existing rules or the proposed rules that, first of all, addresses ballot marking devices now that we have statutory language around ballot marking devices. And I wasn't able to find anything in the existing or proposed rules specific to being able to accessibly verify write-in candidates. So I'd like to see that added. And then I also
May I interrupt?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but wouldn't that already, if it's already in the statute, does it bear repeating in the rules?
Not being an attorney, I can't, I don't know.
Okay.
But personally, I would like to see it in the rules so it's very, very clear that it's required. And this next piece would be the same.
Okay.
Same kind of situation. In the new statute, we have language that defines how a ballot is cast in any polling place where a ballot marking device is available for accessible use, for accessible voting. And the language of that statute is, in my opinion, pretty clear that whether or not that device is actually used by any voter in that polling place, every voter in that polling place will have their ballot cast by it being deposited in the ballot box, or it could be the optical scan counter, by an election judge. And because that is such a significant change from previous statute, and I think there does need to be a rule in there to make it very clear. And the rule might say something like, the election judge in charge of the ballot box shall deposit every elector's ballot card in the ballot box, regardless of whether the elector marked the ballot manually, using the ballot marking device, or by other means. That's it.
Thank you.
And I do have...
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you very much. Next, David Larson.
Hi, my name is Dave Larson. I'm with Colorado Olins for Voting Integrity. And I have two comments, one regarding the audits in section... I'm sorry. My first comment, I guess, start with Rule 43.8.8.2. This provides for mail-in ballots or provisional ballots
in case
of equipment failure or inadequate backup equipment availability. Here is all we have to protect voter access to the paper ballot at the polls in Colorado. This is where the whole bill will have a positive effect on our elections, if it were to pass. The better solution here is to require a method of providing markable paper ballots in case any lines develop. I have been told that the Secretary of State is strongly recommending election officials to provide paper ballots at all polling places. Here's the place where that would have been put in the rules. To obtain the desired results, 43.8.8.2 would call for inventories of paper ballots or the availability of instant ballot printing to be used without special permission of the Secretary of State in case of, or in addition to the listed ballot printing, to be used without special permission of the Secretary of State.
Let me make sure I understand. You're suggesting that this rule will be a convenient place to require counties to have the ability to print additional ballots when they need them without having permission of the Secretary of State.
Correct, and that they be regular ballots and not provisional ballots, and that they be generated by, or they could be generated by a ballot producing automark. Is upper certification.
Okay.
I can't find the other. That's all for now.
Okay, and I'll give you, if you think of it, then you come back up later.
Can I submit?
Yes, thank you very much. Next, I believe it's Gary Lackland, or maybe Kerry. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. Okay. My name is Kerry Lackland. I'm with Coloradans for Voting Integrity. I'm on the board of directors. Mr. Larson just submitted a written document from Harvey Branscom, who's also on the board of directors. He was hoping to be here from Eagle County. He's on the board of directors for Colorado for Voting Integrity. He's also co-chairman of the Democratic Party in Eagle County. He's been involved in the development of legislation and passage of legislation in the last legislative session of the Colorado General Assembly. I'd like to read just the first part of what he states in his written document, because I think Colorado's Voting Integrity would join in that statement. Mr. Secretary of State, election reformers, legislators, and all interested parties, here are my comments on the final draft election rules pursuant to statutory changes from the 2007 Colorado legislature for insertion in public comments on August 7, 2007. These rules affect many diverse portions of the election statutes, including those which are independent of any 2007 legislative statutory changes. The Secretary of State's office has apparently ignored some of the public interest motivated changes which were adopted in Senate Bill 83 during the 2007 Colorado legislative session. An overview of the problems with the final draft of this rule as presented today fall into several categories: typographical errors, sloppy descriptions, inconsistencies and misunderstandings of statute, omissions of statutory changes. The rules as proposed remain inadequate, misleading, confusing, and incomplete, as well as sustaining a lack of public transparency, which we believe was never intended by the Colorado legislature. This rulemaking process should be set aside until significant revisions are completed and submitted once again for review and public comment. It's my understanding that these rules were originally published in June. At that time, it seemed to us, the Colorado Voting Integrity, that the Secretary of State's office had almost totally ignored the work of the 2007 Colorado legislature. Some of those changes, as have already been mentioned, the mail-in ballot provisions have now been incorporated in the revised draft of the proposed rules as of August 2nd. The public and our organization has only had 5 days to analyze exactly what you have done or not done with the statutory changes passed by the Colorado legislature, and we think that is inadequate period of time for a transparent and thorough public comment. We would ask the Secretary of State's office to extend the rulemaking process and have additional public hearings. In the chance that this is our only chance to comment, we would like to join in the comments of Faith Gross from the Legal Center that the Secretary of State's office seems to have ignored significant portions of Senate Bill 83 concerning ballot marking devices. The history of ballot marking devices is quite poignant in Colorado. Colorado has a statutory provision that accessible votes by disabled voters need to be cast in an independent and secret manner, which I think everyone supports. Unfortunately, prior secretaries of state have interpreted that statutory provision as preventing Colorado from certifying ballot marking devices. And ballot marking devices have been available since sometime, I think, in the early 2000. Ballot marking devices have been certified in 48 states. The only two states that have not yet certified ballot marking devices for use in general elections are Colorado and Arkansas. When we testified at a hearing earlier with the Secretary of State's office in the fall, we presented our concerns that ballot marking devices had not yet been certified, and we presented testimony from Mr. Noel Runyon, software and accessibility expert, who's also a disabled blind voter from California, indicating, and we submitted his study that showed that ballot marking devices were the best mechanism for disabled voters to cast a verifiable and secure ballot. We had conversations at that time with members of the Secretary of State staff, and we were informed that they did not anticipate that, ballot marking devices would be certified before the 2007 or 2008 elections because of the statutory provisions in Colorado statute that existed at that time. Colorado's Voting Integrity and other voting integrity groups, along with the Legal Center and other disabled voter groups, worked very hard during the legislative session to come up with a compromise involving ballot marking devices. We invited the Secretary of State's office to participate in that discussion, and my experience in attending, I think, all of the hearings on Senate Bill 83 and all of the legislative testimony on the floor of both houses was that the Secretary of State's office took no position and basically was silent. And so the legislature, at the urging of both the disabled community and the voting integrity community, passed the ballot marking device amendments to the statute. And we do not think it's sufficient that these provisions exist only in statute and not in rule. Every other part of the election statutes are incorporated in the rules. We think that this reflects a position by the Secretary of State's office that's antithetical to ballot marking devices. And we think that is not the result of the people's decision in the Colorado legislature to pass this statute, define ballot marking devices, and describe how they should be used in an election. We think that those statutory provisions in Senate Bill 83 should be incorporated in these rules so that it's clear to the clerks and to voters across the state of Colorado that ballot marking devices, if certified, can be used in Colorado elections. And we would urge, I realize that there's a parallel process for the certification, and we hope that the Colorado Secretary of State's office is proceeding with the certification of submitted ballot marking devices by at least ES&S, if not Diable. And the AutoMark is a machine that's used in, I think, over 20 states, and we've solicited comments from disabled voters in many of those states and have gotten a lot of positive feedback, including the state of Michigan, where there's a AutoMark ballot marking device in every precinct. The disabled community is happy with the ability to mark a paper ballot, which is preserved and auditable and verifiable by the voter before it's cast. And I think that Colorado should move in that direction. There isn't time today for me to go through all of Mr. Branscombe's comments, but we submit that this process, as it stands today, is flawed and should be continued for further public hearing and further time for the public to digest what the Secretary of State's office published 5 days ago.
Thank you, Mr. Lackland. I do have a couple of questions. And let me start with a comment. We usually don't repeat the statutes and the rules. In fact, some of the comments that we've gotten, the written comments that we received before today, were critical of areas where they saw the statutes being repeated in the rules. So I was a little surprised by your comments about not repeating the statutory provisions on ballot marking devices. But I guess my specific question is there anything that's not in the statute on that subject that you think needs to be put in the rules? Is there anything missing that needs to be supplemented in the rules?
I can't identify anything at this moment, but I think the statute is pretty definitive, and we worked very hard on trying to get the proper language in every sentence of that statute. So if that's the proper way for the Secretary of State's office to proceed, to leave it to the statute to define the definition of ballot marking devices and its operation, we're fine with that. It just seems a little inconsistent to talk about some of the voting systems. And in fact, in Rule 11, page 20 of the proposed rules, the Secretary of State's office goes into great detail defining election software, election voting device, electronic vote tabulating equipment, electromechanical voting system. And it seems like the word electromechanical voting system on page 20 of the amended rules on May 30th of 2007 refers to something similar to a ballot marking device. But it requires that type of system, the electromechanical voting system, is a system in which an elector votes using a device for marking a paper ballot using ink or other visible substance, and the votes are counted with electronic vote tabulating equipment. I think the beauty of a paper ballot, both for all voters, whether disabled or not, is that a paper ballot can be hand counted and isn't necessarily subjected to an optical scanner or any other type of vote tabulating equipment. This is especially important in recounts or audits, where a paper ballot in contradiction to a direct record electronic device, a DRE, the actual ballot that the voter casts and indicates the voter's intent can actually be reviewed. We hope that Colorado moves away from DRE devices. We think that the recent actions by the California Secretary of State in decertifying three of the DRE systems because of deficiencies and vulnerabilities of those systems, and the limiting in California in, I think, 34 counties to one DRE machine for the upcoming 2008 elections is the handwriting on the wall for Colorado. And we think that the Secretary of State's office should review the work, the substantial work that the Secretary of State's office in California has done in reviewing the vulnerabilities of the DRE machines. We think that these machines put Coloradan and American democracy at risk and should be discontinued and rejected. At least we believe that in the next 2008 election, whether this is by statute or by rule, that DRE machines, for accessible machines for disabled voters, should be limited to one machine per precinct or per voting center, and that the rest of the ballots in Colorado be cast on paper ballots. A shift and a certification to AutoMark or some other ballot marking device would allow all voters to vote by electronic machine on a paper ballot, which is preservable, verifiable, and auditable. So we will be submitting additional comments as we have a chance to review the August 2nd proposed changes. We will make suggestions, and I think we may disagree with some of the other comments that have been made previously by other people about whether rules should repeat statutes, but it seems that some statutes are emphasized by repetition in the rules and some are not, and we're very concerned that the Secretary's office seems to have a bias against ballot marking devices. And I think that those devices are supported by a broad range of voting integrity and disabled voter groups, and we would ask the Secretary of State's office to respond to that.
Let me ask you one other question,
yes,
if I might. At the beginning of your testimony, you read from Harvey Branscombe's comments, and,
yes,
and you said that, and quoting from his email, if I can find it, it says the Secretary of State's office has apparently ignored some of the changes that were adopted in Senate Bill 83. I think your comments about the AutoMark would be an example. Are there other omissions that you wanted to point out?
None that I feel capable of identifying now, and I think Mr. Branscombe goes through those in pretty much detail in his written comments. We will expand and amend those comments.
And he does have a 16 pages here. I didn't see anything about, and there's lots of good comments here about the language that is in the rules omission. Well, there is some stuff about omission, so maybe I'll see it as I go through
and
that.
I would like to second what Mr. Larson testified about regarding the accessibility of paper ballots. The way the rule is written now, there seems to have to be some emergency or some act of God for the Secretary of State's office to approve a clerk using paper ballots on election day. And a perfect example of that is Brough County in the 2006 election. The Democratic commissioners did a study of early voting procedures in the lead up to election day in 2006, and their analysis showed that, in fact, the county did not have enough DRE machines, and Brough County is one of those counties that is totally DRE, and they sounded the alarm to the local clerk, who consulted with the Secretary of State's office regarding permission to use paper ballots, because they predicted that there were not enough DRE machines in place for Election Day based upon the length of the ballot, the length of time voters were taking to cast their ballots, and the limit of 12 hours in a day for everyone in that county to vote. The Secretary of State's office denied the Brough County's request to use paper ballots in addition to DRE machines if lines developed. And in fact, on Election Day, by 11 a.m., there were huge lines at all of the precincts and vote. I think there's vote centers in Brough County. And again, a call was made to the Secretary of State's office by at the request of the Democratic commissioners in Brough County, and the clerk again requested permission from the Secretary of State's office to use leftover absentee ballots or provisional ballots to reduce the lines, which I think is clearly a disenfranchisement of voters in Colorado when lines develop and people don't have time to wait in line to vote. An extreme example of that, of course, was Denver in 2006. So I think this rule should be amended so that the county clerks, at their discretion, can have sufficient paper ballots printed so that if lines develop or there's a lightning strike or an outage of electricity. I was at a precinct in Boulder County that electricity went out in a precinct and the DRE machine never came back up. Fortunately, Boulder County has a hybrid system which allows voters to vote on paper. And so after 10 a.m., on that election day, in that precinct, every voter cast a paper ballot. If that had been an all DRE precinct in some other county, that precinct would have been out of operation because the DRE machines never came back up. And I think that we have previously advocated for a hybrid system across the state of Colorado where voters have a choice of voting on DRE or paper ballots. We would repeat that request. And in the alternative, we'd ask that this rule that was mentioned by Mr. Larson be expanded so that paper ballots become a viable option for any voter that doesn't trust the DRE machine to adequately record and tabulate their vote, and in the case of where there are excessive lines. And
Mr. Lackland,
voters are disenfranchised.
And I think we're on the same page. I think you're actually incorrect about the situation in Rout County. The Secretary of State actually has encouraged the hybrid system and trying to encourage clerks to have sufficient ballots on hand and the ability to print ballots in exactly those circumstances. So I understand there was a proposal to incorporate that into the rules. So that's, you know,
I was talking about what actually happened on the ground in 2006, and my understanding was that request to use provisional and absentee ballots was denied by the Secretary of State. Whether that position has changed now, I think is commendable, and we would encourage you to expand that so that counties can anticipate lines and can anticipate voters not wanting to vote on DREs and allowing a hybrid system so that paper ballots are available.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Jenny Flanagan.
Good afternoon. afternoon. Hi. My name is Jenny Flanagan. I'm the director of Colorado Common Cause. We work for open, honest, and accountable government. Want to express our gratitude to the Secretary of State's office for the opportunity to provide comments today and all of your work in accepting all of our feedback and working through that to incorporate them in the rules that will ultimately be adopted. I've submitted my rule comments in writing, but I thought it would be helpful to walk through them, and then if there are questions as we go through them,
okay, go ahead.
Encourage us to talk through them.
I haven't had a chance to go through them yet, so it would be helpful to highlight them, I think.
And some of them are just raising concerns or questions that you may be able to address even in this discussion. The first comment is on Rule 2.10.1, which creates a, again, I'm not sure where this was generated from, but it creates a requirement that when a voter changes their voter registration, that they have to provide their date of birth on that information. That may be part of a standard form. Originally, the June 15th rules also had a requirement for a Social Security number, and we are glad to see that that requirement has been removed, and it currently only states that the date of birth is required. And as you all know, we live in an era where identity theft and concerns about our identity is really paramount in the minds of our people. And any additional burdens asking for identification is always something that raises an eyebrow for us. So we weren't sure where that issue was generated from. Second issue is Rule 2.10.4, which addresses the ability for changes to be made via fax for mail-in ballot registration. And I wasn't sure if this ability to fax documents to counties or to the Secretary of State applies to all materials or is it limited to this circumstance for mail-in balloting. So we had a question about that. This issue actually hasn't come up. This was one of the changes to Senate Bill 83 around Rule 11.5.4.4 and other parts of Rule 11 that talk about the audit provision. One of the changes to Senate Bill 83 was to increase the audit to all races, ballot questions, and ballot issues to be included as part of the audit. The change to the rule explains that at least two races would be included in the random audit. We just want to make clear that all races would be included in this as the random selection of which races and which machines would be selected for the audit, that that's accounted for. And it seems that this rule is, I'm not sure that it's in conflict with the provision, but I'm not sure that it addresses the intent of that provision to ensure that all races would be included. Additionally, around the post-election audit, one of the changes, and I know there's been some discussion already today in terms of, you know, what's in our statute and what belongs in the rules, and I don't pretend to have the answer to that, but I think, as Faith Gross talked about, where there has been confusion about statutory provisions, the rules do provide that extra guidance for both county administrators and those who are interested parties in our elections to really understand where the Secretary of State falls in interpreting a particular statute. So this provision that we're addressing in Rule 11.5.4.11 is that a description of the audit process be included in the report after the post-election audit is complete. That provision came up in Senate Bill 83 because there was really a dearth of information about what happened in those post-election audits. Although it was posted, you know, in a timely manner on the Secretary of State's site, oftentimes there was more to the post-election audits than one could see just by looking at the final report, which showed these are the machines that we counted and this was the result of the audit, oftentimes showing a match. But if you talk to the folks who participate in those audits, you find that throughout the process, there were discrepancies caused by either a machine or a paper or human error, and those are the kinds of descriptive pieces that seem appropriate for these post-election reports and is now part of our laws. And so our recommendation would be to include it in the rules. The next comment has to do with Rule 12.3.2, and this, in fact, was adopted in the April rulemaking, or it was April or May earlier this year. But I wanted to just raise this issue for the record, and this has to do with the county clerks presenting written procedures on walk-in balloting during mail elections. And it's our understanding that this provision is when the counties now have to, because of the Help America Vote Act, provide accessible voting systems for the disabled community during mail balloting times. So the questions that have been raised, what does that mean for other voters, and what does that mean for the disabled community? Are these walk-in voting locations considered polling places because they would have the voting machines, because they would have election judges, they would have to verify somebody's registration in order to allow them to use the machine? Does that turn it into a polling place? Because that would then have implications for other voters and their ability to utilize the services provided at the walk-in balloting location. Am I understanding correctly? Okay. It's our recommendation that we support this approach and would recommend that these walk-in balloting locations be treated as polling places, not only to provide the services of those locations to all voters who may need a replacement ballot. Again, we're talking about mail balloting elections, and there are going to be a lot of voters who don't have the resources or means to get all the way to the county's offices for services, but also, importantly, to dilute the vote of the disabled community who choose to use the machines on election day. That's an issue that's been raised in other states who have been, and even some of the examples when we're looking at one DRE in a polling location, that we encourage other people to use that machine so we dilute the vote, and it's, again, makes it easier for voter security and privacy. Other questions around this part of Rule 12 is in sort of understanding how a clerk and recorder determines the number of walk-in locations. Are there rules, or is there a procedure that they follow for that? The other issue, or the other question that we wanted to raise, was around the length of time that the machines would be available. Was that in? So there's a reference in subsection K talking about the length of time the machines would be available, and we weren't sure if that referred to the number of hours or the number of days, if it's during early voting. It wasn't very clear to me, so I raise that because perhaps maybe it wouldn't be clear to others. Keep plugging. The next comment is on Rule 12.5.1. And this is, I know we've all had discussions about the switch from calling our absentee ballot process to now mail-in voting or mail-in balloting. I think in this instance, there is some confusion because there are many opportunities for a voter to participate by voting through mail. And in this rule, it states that the mail-in ballot voting occurs in a mail election only when the registered eligible voter requests that the mail be sent to them in a different location. To me, that's a definition of what we used to know as absentee balloting, right? I think it's confusing in the way that it's written, because mail balloting can occur in other ways, not only by request for a different location, so that mail balloting can occur during any mail election and any in-person election, just by, for example, signing up for the permanent mail list, that a voter would automatically be on that list. In a mail-only election, a voter can request a one-time ballot to be sent to a different location for any reason. And again, even if it's a in-person election, that voter can still request a one-time mail-in ballot. I'm not explaining it right because I think it is a little bit confusing, but I just wanted to point out, I think there are so many options for a voter to participate through mail-in voting, and this rule seemed a little bit unclear. The next provision was addressed by the Vote by Mail Project through Kristen Thompson on the drop-off locations during early voting, so I don't think I need to address that. Also, Rule 13.17.1 addresses an issue that was also raised through the Vote by Mail Project and Kristen. And we agree that having a timeline so it's made clear that voters have a clear expectation, and our counties have a clear expectation providing information to voters about the time, whether or not their absentee or mail-in ballot had been processed. And certainly if it's on election day, the rule references in a timely manner, and it's our recommendation to think about it in as timely as possible, so that if the information is available to the voter, that we get it to the voter so that they can remedy the situation if, for example, they mailed their ballot 2 weeks ago and found that it hadn't been received yet. There may have been a problem through transmission. The next rule, 16.6.3 and Rule 20, these address the petition requirements, and that was in Senate Bill 83, some of the changes, so that a petitioner no longer has to be a registered voter but just needs to meet the requirements of voter registration. In this rule, it talks about how an individual circulator would be in compliance with this rule. I guess we just weren't sure how the Secretary of State's office would make that determination and what would be what would sufficient evidence to challenge that. Just sort of raise some questions for us, and we wanted to hear your response or in a future discussion hear a response. The same goes for Rule 20 repeal, and this addressed protest for petitioners. Senate Bill 83 talked about candidate petition protests and the ability to go to the district court. How does this repeal affect non-candidate petitioners and their ability to protest? We're not sure if it has an implication. I'm sure that you probably have thought about it, but we couldn't, I guess, determine the purpose or the scope of what the impact would be just by looking at the rule. For Rule 26.1.2A, this has to do with treating provisional ballots and what to do with the application. Oftentimes, provisional ballots that may be rejected will use that external form or affidavit as a voter registration. And I think the rules make clear that that those are treated as voter registration and would be rejected as such if they don't meet registration requirements. This new rule seems redundant and unnecessary. It sort of highlights a challenging issue that I think our state has been dealing with on how to treat eligible voters who have a history of a felony conviction. This rule, in our opinion, is unnecessary and could be intimidating for voters who may have a history of a felony conviction but are still eligible to vote. And we certainly take the position that we would encourage those folks to participate and would discourage any kind of intimidating language. Rule 30 is our rule around our IDs and lists of acceptable IDs. Common Cause has continually advocated for a rule to clarify that a government document that shows the name and address of the electors, which is allowed by HAVA, should also include a certified letter from a state or federal, state, or county, or municipal government service organization, or a certificate of registration issued by a county clerk. All of us know the hurdles that folks in Colorado have to go through in order to obtain ID. We've seen a lot of news, and there's been a lot of discussion up at the legislature on those challenges. And ID should not be what prohibits somebody from participating in our voting process. It's not required by law that folks can't participate without these IDs. There are ways around it, and by including more options for ID, we think voters would be able to participate with greater ease. And we think that this recommendation of allowing a government document fits within HAVA and within our state laws, and encourage the Secretary to consider adopting that. While we're talking about IDs, I also wanted to raise another issue that's been kind of going through changes in our state law, and that is how we treat voters who do not provide the proper identification numbers when they are registering for the first time by mail. Now, we've gone through a couple of different, and I don't have that in my written document. I apologize. I'm still kind of formulating how to approach this, because I think we've been going through so many changes with how we treat voter the ID requirements as kind of coming down from HAVA. And I understand in 2006, the Secretary of State worked with the Election Assistance Commission to make statutory changes to further make or to make clear what ID requirements are required on the voter registration drive. I think the practical application in talking with groups who are doing voter registration, that oftentimes that voter may not have their driver's license with them when they're filling out that form. Now, it has been and continues to be in some of our election rules, so I'm just not clear what our procedure would be. It's certainly our recommendation that the voter be registered and then tagged as ID deficient. And then our county clerks have an opportunity to contact that voter, whether through mail and postcard or phone contact. Those are approaches that have been in place, is my understanding. But by not putting the voter on the registration list and tagging them as ID deficient, really eliminate them from the process. In order for the ballot to be counted, we have to verify that voter ID in some way, shape, or form. Or that voter needs to provide ID when they come to the polling place, or they can remedy that ID deficiency at any time prior to the election. We recommend that practice be kept in place and, again, register that voter and then tag them as ID deficient and give them the opportunity to remedy that tag, rather than not registering the voter, which we think would cause much more problems and really be confusing for the voter and deny them their opportunity to participate.
May I ask you a quick question, Wayne Munster? You mentioned federal, state, county, or municipal government service organization. Are we talking about like WIC, you know, human services type organizations?
You know, this language was proposed in 2006 during the session.
Uh-huh.
I think in Senate Bill 170 was the
yeah.
election omnibus bill that went through that session, and it got some discussion, but ultimately did come out of the bill. Suggestion here, it could be a service organization that, I mean, I think there's some flexibility in how we approach that, but I think by making it a certified document, maybe a service organization that is funded by government, that would define it sort of as a government service agency. So some of our community health services or things like that, where voters who are low income and may not have the forms of ID that are required, could get a certified letter or, you know, under a government heading
and
to meet this requirement.
You would anticipate the Secretary of State's office to come up with the form of this certified letter to distribute to these agencies, or?
I think in the same manner that the Secretary's office had adopted a rule for students to use a letter by university offices, that could be a similar type of approach that the Secretary could take.
Thank you.
Thank you for bearing with me. I've just got a few more. Rule 38.3.4 talks about the vote center poll book, and this was, again, another provision that was debated during this legislative session, and the intention was for the Secretary to create a rule for an electronic poll book backup, so a contingency plan should anything happen with the electronic poll book if any failure were to occur. Subsection B is the one alternative that we're concerned doesn't really meet the requirement of that contingency goal, because it doesn't address the file that would be available. It talks only about a battery life of the document, and unless I'm misreading it, I'm not sure that meets the goal of the requirement. So we would consider, you know, we would urge the Secretary to consider that comment and either rewrite or incorporate some of the other components of that rule into that section so that it is a meaningful backup for that electronic.
And I bear with me. I was trying to find in 38.3.4, let's see, in B, okay.
Page 49.
I mean, I initially assumed that meant that these were computers that were not connected to anything, but each would have a database on the computer itself.
And again, while the Section A and Section C make clear that it's an electronic backup of the current poll book or a backup of the poll book, Section B only talks about the computers and ensuring that the registration is done in a consistent, that it keeps going in an efficient manner, doesn't address what would be on those computers in terms of the backup.
Okay.
So that's why if that's listed as one of the only options or an acceptable option, it could be that contingency plan is not met.
Okay, thank you.
Another issue that's raised, and I think that Harvey actually raises this also, is whether how the poll book will be, or how the process will be treated in case of a failure to keep track or note of the voters who do cast ballots during that downtime. I know that there are different procedures that other that counties do. It is sort of a varied practice, is my understanding. But calling into the central location is one option. But as we experienced certainly in Denver, that wasn't really an option because it was hard to get through on the phone. So is there going to be a mechanism required that the individuals utilizing that static poll book keep track of the voters who are participating and somehow update that? Rule 38.4.2 and 3 addresses how the electronic poll books work. I don't pretend to be an expert on technology, and I know that some of the stuff gets a little bit complicated. But in this section, it talks, bear with me a second, let me just find it. It talks about a system being able to handle processing a voter 1 minute per voter. That's the time, that's the maximum allowed. My initial reaction is that oftentimes when a voter checks into for voter registration, some voters will be processed in such a quick fashion, but many have name changes or address changes, or they think they're registered, but they're in another county, that there are so many reasons why it might take a voter a little bit longer to get through that process. And if that's the maximum period we're basing our planning on, that could be problematic. And then finally, there are a couple of things that weren't addressed in the rules. I don't believe the case is because it's addressed in statute, especially when we're thinking about the guidelines for vote centers. I understand the rules do address contingency plans for poll books, but part of the other reforms that were addressed in Senate Bill 83 and discussed in the legislature was an effort to really define best practices, talking about, again, planning for vote centers and utilizing the expertise in some of the counties that have had successful runs at the use of vote centers, that was intended to become part of the rulemaking process. The other issue in terms of voter registration drives, there were a number of changes to those laws, and it may be that that's still in the formulation phase, I'm not sure, but that's something that we would be interested in looking toward. So it's our recommendation for these and other issues that the Secretary, as this office has done on many issues in the past, convene a stakeholders meeting with key election administrators and community leaders and political party folks to think through these important issues and incorporate them.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flanagan. Cynthia Coleman.
Good afternoon. My name is Cynthia Coleman. I'm with the Larimer County Clerk and Recorder's Office. I am here. I have submitted written testimony and would like to just go over a few of those items. I am here on behalf of Scott Doyle. The first item that I would like to go over is page 13, line 6, rule 12.4.11. We have concern over the increase in cost for the ballot envelopes from our current vendor. This type of envelope used in a mail ballot election, is what I'm understanding, would also cause additional labor and processing time. We have had very limited phone calls or complaints from voters since removing the date of birth from the ballot envelope several years ago. And we would like to see this rule as an option for those counties that wish to use. The envelope that covers the signature. We would also like to possibly pursue opportunities to use electronic equipment to assist processing and signature verification, similar to what the banking industry currently does for verification of signatures. And this would limit that opportunity and cause possibly cause this technology not to be used. So if we want to look in the future and have opportunities available for saving time and increasing production and increasing accuracy, this would be preventative to that.
Can I ask, I mean, I understand the additional labor and the printing costs, and I understand that the removal of the birth date is helpful with respect to protecting voters from identity theft and so forth. But here the issue is whether or not the signature will be visible on the outside of the envelope, I believe.
That is correct.
And don't you think there would still be voters who are still concerned about their signature going through the mail like that?
I will be honest with you. I've been in Colorado since 2001, and the 2001 mail ballot election, there was huge numbers of complaints because at that time the date of birth was on there. I believe the law was removed in 2003 for the 2003. I cannot remember. I'm pretty sure it was 2003. And at that time, we received virtually no phone calls in Arapahoe County. I have recently moved to Larimer County, but in talking with staff, again, we have virtually no complaints from the public there. You know, we talk about identity theft and things like that. If somebody is intent upon capturing that signature, I would think they would just simply take the ballot.
Okay.
But, again, I do understand the concern, but I would like us to try and look at some way to using technology in the future.
And I wonder about, this might be a little beyond the rulemaking, I'm not sure, but with respect to the capability of existing technology that might help with signature verification, I am kind of curious how that would work. In other words, would it kick out suspect signatures so that there's still a human judgment with the opportunity for observers from both parties to make a judgment and so forth?
And that is exactly what we are looking at.
I mean, there would have to be some degree of confidence, though, that I assume that the technology is at the state where it could kick out the appropriately suspect signatures, and everyone can kind of agree that it's doing a pretty good job. And I don't quite know how to begin that inquiry, but maybe that's something we could pursue. We have talked about it.
Yeah, we have. Mr. Doyle was at a regional conference. Participants, state of California, Utah, Oregon, Washington, and that type of technology was discussed at that time. It sounds very promising.
Thank you.
Let's see. On page 14, line 10, rule 12.10.2, we noted that the current statute 1.7.5, 17, paren 3, DI, it only references the sworn statement, basically stating that there shall be a sworn statement. With the removal of the rules, it appears that there is no longer a sworn statement for replacement ballots, and I just wanted to point that out.
And what you're looking for is the text of what the statement would be.
If a text is needed, then it's the forms committee or who is responsible then for providing that sworn statement to us. Page 17, line 7, rule 13.15. We are requesting further clarification in regards to the statement as when the insertion process is complete. We believe this would be helpful so that we understand what our timelines are and what the timelines with the vendor is. We do have a concern that this may create a hardship for the counties if ballot certification is held up in court. Basically, it seems like there may be a possible conflict between CRS 15403, which requires the county clerk to be in possession of the official ballots 32 days before the election. CRS 18111 requires a mail-in ballot to be mailed to a voter within 72 hours after receipt of the application or after printed ballots are delivered to the DEO. So we're just concerned about a little bit of conflict there. It may be possible that the insertion process would begin with our vendor in advance of them actually being printed and put in the mail stream. So what are our guidelines? What is the necessary dates? So just some clarification, we would appreciate that. Page 27, line 14, rule 22.1. And I am not sure about the legislation and the court case on this, but it appears by removing issue petitions from rule, there may be no recourse for counties when they're checking issue petitions. So we just wanted to make note of that. Page 49, line 33, rule 38.4.2. We do not know how you want us to compute the minimum 5 computers for every 10,000 voters. When you're doing a vote center, where are the 10,000 voters? Is it the 10,000 voters in the county? Is it based in an area of the vote center? What is that? We gave a specific example where we utilize a vote center, Red Feather Lakes, and we actually have 150 to 300 electors cast a ballot, depending on the type of the election. So, one, we don't have space at that site for 5 computers, and second, it does not seem necessary for that number of voters to have that many computers. On page 50, line 29, rule 38.5.2, we believe that 60% is too high. The computers in Larimer County, the computers are not connected until the day before at the vote center sites. Okay. We obviously need that test conducted prior to that time, prior to advance, and we believe that 45% is more doable. Basically, what happens is we do a load test, and I think counties do handle Citrix differently. We would request that the test is adequate for the system as defined in the county security plan. The way load testing is handled can be different. We have a Citrix farm where we have 5 servers. We basically take one server down at a time and check the load test to see how they're operating. We stay within 20 to 40 seconds for processing voters using this and have not had any issues. We are requesting that 45% or possibly having something set so that it is based on election type. For a primary, it would be a lower requirement. For the general, it might. And I have other comments that are submitted, but I'll let you guys read through those. And if you have any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Cynthia, if you don't mind, you know, you're looking for clarification on 13.15 and several other rules. I don't know how long Mr. Hobbs is going to leave the record open, but if you would like to present suggestions, you know, and submit those in writing, we'd love the assistance since, you know, Larimer County is an expert in the vote center field.
Mr. Doyle and are out of state right now. They are at Election Center. They would be more than happy to submit those comments, any assistance, and they would just ask if it would be possible to do that next week, if that is possible or not. We can do something else.
I need to think about it. I did anticipate leaving the record open until the close of business on Friday. And I don't know whether there's some timing issues as far as adopting the rules and getting them published, and we face deadlines, filing deadlines when we adopt rules, so I need to kind of think that through.
But and that's fine. We would certainly accommodate whatever is necessary for the Secretary's office.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
I don't have anybody else signed up. I don't think someone has signed up in addition. And David Larson, I don't know whether you had wanted, did you have anything you wanted to add again? You it seemed like you had one point you had missed.
Well, there was a point in.
I need to have you at the mic, I'm sorry. Just for the broadcast and for the recording.
was a, again, this, my name's Dave Larson, and there was a point, I think it might be on the second page of Harvey's, regarding audits. He makes a point regarding the audits that they're more like recounts and not audits, and that the minimum amount of ballots within the audit is an insufficient amount to produce any kind of statistical confidence factor that the audit uncovers what it's supposed to do. I mean, audits are meant to uncover irregularities, and requiring 1% is not enough. I don't have his comments.
Okay.
And the other thing, actually, I was going to comment about, it's more a question regarding Rule 45.5.2.6. And it seems like, I think that's the rule, it goes on for pages, and it outlines exactly the software requirements. Specifically, maybe on page 66, I think this is still the same rule. And here, I'm a software developer, and I see that you've laid out like really detailed requirements for the software, which are good. I mean, these were followed by software developers, there would be far less problems. Yep. And this is supposedly for all voting systems submitted for certification after March 31st, 2008. My question is, in order to determine this, you would have to actually look at the software of the systems. And this software made available, can the Secretary of State's office actually look at the software? I mean, you have many, many pages of requirements. And the day that you published this information was the day that the University of California, Berkeley, released their source code review of two of the systems, Diebold and Sequoia. And they found results that would essentially make both of those systems fail almost all of these requirements. So my question is, like, if you have all these requirements in here, how are you going to actually determine whether or not their software fulfills these? And if there's evidence that they don't fulfill it right now, like, shouldn't there be something put in the rules that this has to be checked by March 31st of next year? Where does that leave us with these machines that are going to be used, that have already been proven by independent auditors and software experts? None of these rules have been, or there's so many problems with the software. So that was okay. That was my point regarding that rule. I think the rules, how they're written, are awesome. I mean, they're really, really complete, and they take into account common problems, and they address like the exact software problems that were found to be in both Diebold and Sequoia machines, not just DREs, but optical scanners and software, the counting software.
Okay. Well, I'll make a note of that as well. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on the proposed rules? Seeing none, then I will leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Friday. If anybody has written comments, please get them to the Secretary of State's office, specifically to Hillary Rudy, if possible, by the end of the day on Friday. And If there's nothing else, then I'll adjourn the meeting. For the record, the time is 2:50 p.m. Thank you very much for attending. Thanks.